Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. From ice cores to hotspots, there's a lot happening on the wireless technology scene in Calgary, and supporting that innovation is Calgary Technologies, Inc. And on the forestry front, protecting biodiversity and promoting sustainability comes down to our acceptance of visionary science. Forest ecologist Dr. Hamish Kimmins talks about how far we've come towards true ecosystem management of our forests. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. My last trip to Calgary included a visit to Calgary Technologies, Inc., which is located in the Research Park just north of the University of Calgary campus. A number of startup companies in the tech sector call CTI home, and on this particular day, CTI was holding its annual open house and showcase.
John Masters, President and CEO of Calgary Technologies, Inc.
You're having an open house here today, and already, just by looking at the parking lot, there's cars everywhere, all around the building and up on the grass. How many people do you expect at the open house today?
Well, we've got 40 companies exhibiting. We've got about 400 people who have RSVP'd the event. And those are all people from outside the building. And then we probably have about 400 people that live in the building. So we estimate that we'll be probably somewhere between 600 to 800 that'll walk through the door over the 3 hours.
What role does Calgary Technologies, Inc. play in the city?
We're the economic development agency focused on the technology sector, from information technology, life sciences, and engineering sciences. We help emerging startup technology companies get off the ground. We provide mentoring and coaching, and we also provide physical incubation facilities for companies to physically locate their offices and their operations here.
What do you see as being the emerging strengths from the companies that are housed here?
We have a really diverse range of companies, predominantly in the information communications technology environment, but they spread across medical application software, wireless application, geomatics. So there's just a wide variety of companies, and probably the most single largest strength would be in the wireless technology area.
One of the things that I've noticed about Calgary Technologies, Inc. is that you're also hooked up with the wireless technologies that are going on, and you have these hotspots, for example, all around the city. What's that all about?
Well, we've initiated a wireless city project, which is to promote the use of wireless technology throughout Calgary and really to develop that culture of use where there are wireless hotspots in public spaces in the community. And we've partnered with the private sector and the telecommunications operators to have relatively low-cost, unencumbered access to have to high-speed internet.
How would people use that?
So people roaming, be it at the airport, be it in downtown, can use their PDAs, can use their laptops to download and to access the internet, to use their email, to have a single device to be connected.
What's your main focus for this year?
Building our mentoring and coaching, as well as building a vision for the new University Research Park. So on the mentoring and coaching side, we focus on emerging technology companies. On the building our new vision for the Research Park, working in partnership with the University of Calgary, Alberta Infrastructure, the City of Calgary, and ourselves, we consider that what we have here in the park is only about maybe a quarter of what we could have in the park. So we're developing a new conceptual master plan for the park for a long-term vision that we can increase the density, increase the population, and have greater connectivity with the university.
Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome.
My name is Richard Belzel. I'm the director of the Wireless City Program for Calgary Technologies. And I guess we're here to talk about this this helmet project that we've done.
Yes, you've got a riding helmet here with an antenna on it. What's this all about?
Well, we put together a wireless city project to showcase some of the technology elements that are made here in the Calgary area and some of the ways that you can use that technology. This one in particular uses precision GPS technology, and we're using it at Spruce Meadows to track the location of a rider on the international ring and be able to compare the exact track that that rider took with tracks that perhaps other riders took. So you could use it for television commentary or for training purposes.
Now, is this a prototype or are you selling it?
This is kind of a funny turn of events. Wireless City is a program really targeted at showcasing the technologies that come out of Calgary. What we set out to do here was to showcase some of the technology elements that are made here in Calgary. We didn't really set out to produce a product, but this is what we've done. So now we have this potential product that somebody can take to market. And now we're really looking for the next steps there to say, well, okay, if this is going to be an interesting product and many people are expressing interest in it, how will that be carried forward? Because it isn't really what we set out to do at all.
Well, certainly it's a very specialized thing, but not everybody is going to be riding a horse. How else might it be used?
Well, there's actually been a number of applications talked about in a number of what you would call high-performance sports. So things like bobsledding or cross-country skiing, biathlon, that sort of thing, where you're out in the open and your course position is of value compared with others on the course at the same time, either for television purposes or for just plain old training purposes. So there's you know, the precision sports, as well as there's actually a wider variety of equestrian sports that can use it. This is for show jumping is what we started with, but you could use it for dressage, or you could use it for just plain old horse racing, just thoroughbred racing.
How does Calgary stand in comparison to the rest of the world market on wireless?
Well, Calgary, certainly I think in Canada, we're really emerging as the foremost center for the development of wireless technologies in the country. Although we have very good working relationships with many companies in the British Columbia, Vancouver area, and also in the Ottawa area. And then on the world stage, of course, there's technologies like you're looking at right here, which are absolutely world class in terms of the precision GPS, which is kind of what Calgary industry really excels at. Seldom in the commodities area, you won't see a lot of commodity products coming out of Calgary, some. But generally speaking, in the high-value, high-knowledge component products that really leverage off of the well-educated workforce here in Calgary.
Thank you very much, Richard.
That's my pleasure. Glad to talk to you about it.
My name is Brian Anushko. I work with REA Solutions, and I'm Director of Sales for Western North America and Asia Pacific.
What is REA Solutions?
REA Solutions is a Calgary-based company that's been in business for about 8 years now. We work as a consulting and systems integration company in the call center industry. We have grown over the last 8 years on a regular basis of about 40% per year. And we do projects with large contact centers around the world.
So what is it that you're doing that's different from other companies that deal with call centers?
I think what's very different from a perspective of our competitors in the industry that are companies like IBM and Accenture and TELUS and Bell Canada is our only focus is customer care. So our approach when we meet with contact center managers, vice presidents of customer care inside most organizations is a little bit different. Philosophically, we're really quite focused on the customer. And the customers, sort of the customer care vision within an organization, really ensuring that as we do consulting work, as we do systems integration work in their contact center technologies, we really understand what the business is trying to achieve in dealing with their clients.
You mentioned growth, and I see that you've been voted into the top 100 fastest growing companies by Profit Magazine. What's the secret to your success? Why are you growing so fast?
I think the reason why we're growing quickly is we're a people-based company, and we've really been successful at hiring some of the best people in the Canadian landscape in the customer care technology sector. We also are very passionate about what we do, and very reality focused on our particular market. So. Yeah, some people might view that as more of a conservative approach towards an industry. We really just manage our company in a very balanced fashion and really make sure that the risk-reward equation, I guess, is really balanced towards our people and our clients.
What's your association with CTI?
We've been partnered with CTI subsequent to our president going through the incubator program a couple of years ago. And Calgary Technologies is looking to REA Solutions is to partner with us is really showcasing us as a successful Calgary story. a successful Calgary business that's competing in the global market space and has really taken advantage of the programs here and the visibility that we get through being affiliated with Calgary Technologies.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
My name's Chris Hill, and I'm president of Canatech Associates International Limited.
I understand you guys are the ice guys. What's that? What are you doing with the ice?
Well, we're basically ice consultants, and we do really four things in ice. One is what I call conventional consulting. If somebody has some question, some concern in ice, especially the offshore petroleum industry, we're the people that they will come to for information, interpretation, and some guidance on how to carry out an operation in sea ice. We also offer what we call a regional reconnaissance, getting a big picture of what the ice looks like in a customer's area of interest, like right now, and getting it to them when it's still topical. We offer on-site ice monitoring service and ice forecasting, and as a result of all this, we were able to build up an interesting library of proprietary software that we can sell over and over again.
Now, I see that Canatech was up at the Arctic at the North Pole during the summer. What were you doing up there?
We're quite proud of that, actually. In August and September of this year, there was what was called the Arctic Coring Expedition, an international research project, and it got together three ocean-going icebreakers of three nations, including a Russian CIS nuclear icebreaker, and they all headed up to the Lomonosov Ridge, about 200 kilometers from the North Pole, and believe it or not, actually got one of the vessels to hold still for actually up to eight consecutive days while they drilled 420 meters of sea bottom sediments. And it's sea bottom sediments that the climatologists of the world are eagerly waiting to analyze because it holds, we hope, a record of 50 million years of climate change in the Earth.
What was one of the challenges of being up there?
Well, certainly it was actually getting up there is one thing, certainly, because this is an area that even in the height of summer in August was completely covered by moving pack ice. Getting one single vessel to just hold steady over a drilling position long enough to get 420 meters of core is an operation that hasn't been accomplished before, and this one came off successful in all respects.
Now, I see you're promoting IceTech 2006 in Banff. What's IceTech?
Well, IceTech is it's the short form for the International Conference and Exhibition on Performance of Ships and Structures in Ice. Quite a mouthful. This should be the seventh such conference, and it's being totally organized by the Arctic section of the Society of Naval Architects and Marine Engineers. And the Arctic section of this society, funnily enough, is concentrated right here in Calgary, 1,000 kilometers from the sea, but where there is a very active community of offshore, particularly polar and ice marine specialists.
Now, why would that be?
Well, this goes back to the first offshore exploration program in the Beaufort Sea, and that's getting back 25 years when the major oil companies at the time involved in the offshore exploration, quite simply, they brought the best offshore marine people in the world together in Calgary. And although the Beaufort Sea activity of years ago has dwindled, the people they brought in stay.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cheryl.
That was Chris Hill, president of Canatech Associates International. And while jostling through the crowd at the open house at Calgary Technologies, Inc., I also spoke with Brian Inesco of Area Solutions, Richard Belzil, director of CTI's Wireless City program, and John Masters, CTI's president and CEO. For more than a dozen years, I've heard the name Hamish Kimmins mentioned with deep reverence whenever the topic of new forestry is discussed. Hamish is a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia, and his specialty is ecosystem management simulation modeling. Hamish is considered the father of ecosystem management in Canada, and his vision of how we must integrate all the values of the forest has changed the way forestry is practiced in this country. He spoke at the recent international conference, One Forest, Under Two Flags.
It seems there's nothing new under the sun. If you look at what the Greeks and the Romans did 2,000 years ago in the Eastern Mediterranean, if you look at what happened in Central Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, and what's happened in the last 50 years of Canada, you can identify some similar trends. At first, people simply exploit forests, because when there are few people with little technology, it's hard for them to really change nature very much. Nature can replace more than they can take. But as the number of people and the power of their technology increases, then they start to take more than nature can replace, and they start to change nature. And this happened with forests. Exploitation eventually becomes non-sustainable. At that point, you introduce rules and regulations to try to ensure sustainability of certain values, employment, wealth creation, timber, wildlife habitat for hunting, whatever, doesn't matter. However, those early regulations are very rarely based upon an understanding of the ecology of the values you're trying to sustain. And as a result, they don't work very well. They may maintain a few values, but generally speaking, they don't maintain all the values that society wants. So we go from this early stage that we call administrative forestry to an ecologically based stage where we study the forests and discover how they work and what we need to do to manage them sustainably. However, in this part of the evolution, there is still very much a focus on economics, on employment, and on timber. And so as society changes the values it wants from forests, beauty, spiritual values, water, wildlife, biodiversity, cultural values, as this value set changes, even ecologically based forestry focused on timber doesn't satisfy what we need. So to come to the original question, what has happened in the 36 years I've been in British Columbia? A dramatic change. Coming really out of the post-war period where forestry was strategic, it looked at military needs, it looked at economics, it looked at employment. As society grew richer in the post-war decades, we were able to demand or require more values than just the social ones I've mentioned. Biodiversity, sustainability, stewardship, beauty, recreation, aesthetics are very important values to humans, and forestry rather ignored that. So we've made huge strides forward, partly driven by foresters. Foresters as different from corporations. Corporations are there to serve the shareholders. Foresters are there to serve their profession. And long before environmentalists were active in Canada, it was professional foresters that tried to create changes. But they weren't successful. They were not articulate. They didn't grab the public attention. They didn't make change possible. It was the environmental movement, civil society, putting pressure on governments and corporations to change the way we manage forest that really was the stimulus for enormously beneficial changes that we have seen in forestry.
There's a tremendous amount of research now that's being focused on the forest and how the forest ecosystems work, how we can preserve biodiversity. What are some of the benefits coming out of that, or some of the challenges?
Well, I'll start with the challenges. They're absolutely enormous. The concept of biodiversity is very poorly understood. My advice to a forester who is told to protect biodiversity is go and have a cup of coffee. Now, some people think that's because I don't care about biodiversity. It's exactly the opposite. Because I feel biodiversity is so important and want to pass it on to my grandchildren, we have to understand what it is. There are many different ways of measuring biodiversity. We can measure maybe 10 different ways. We can measure it at a stand level, a hectare, 10 hectares, or at a local landscape, 5,000 hectares, or a large regional landscape, 1 million hectares. And then we find that all measures at all scales change over time. So when you say protect biodiversity, I, as an operational forester, need to know what levels of which measures at which spatial scale with what pattern of change over time I'm trying to manage for. And until I know that, I'm best to sit down and have a cup of coffee and wait for that detail to be provided, or I'll probably do the wrong thing.
What would be the right thing today?
There is no absolute right or wrong. Mount St. Helens exploded, the dinosaurs went extinct. Nature just is. Species come, species go. But we have human ethical and moral values that seems to say we have no ethical right to squander the richness, biological richness provided by evolution. We should try to keep it as intact as possible and pass it on to future generations whilst enjoying it at the same time for ourselves. So our ethical responsibility is to understand what biodiversity is, what sustainability is, and manage our forests so that we can enjoy social and environmental values from the forest today, but also ensure that we do pass them on to future generations.
We've seen a move over the last 10 years towards something called ecosystem management, or within that, something that's called the triad approach, which deals with the ecological and the economical and also the biological aspects of the forest. Is this enough, or do you see something more that we should be moving towards? What's next on the scene?
There are many different paradigms for how forestry should develop. And I think the rule, diversity in everything is good, certainly applies here. I don't think there's one new paradigm that is going to solve all our problems and satisfy all our needs. Just as the single paradigm of post-war silviculture satisfied today's needs, I think there are many different approaches. Ecosystem management, I'm an ecosystem ecologist, I think it's a great idea, we can't do it. We can't do it because our tenure systems license forest companies and professional foresters only to manage for timber, with all other values as a constraint on that objective. That is a recipe for conflict and less than satisfactory management. Until the Canadian public is prepared to allow landscape units to be managed by one entity, this could be a community forest, it could be a government, it could be a company, but to manage one area for all values in balance, only then can we really do ecosystem management. Short of that, we can do ecosystem-based management, in which we look at the ecology of wildlife, the ecology of trees, the ecology of water, and we manage each of these separately. But only when we integrate them do we get true ecosystem management.
Do you see any movement in that direction?
No. People want to go there. The public wants it. I'm not sure that the companies want it because it's extremely complex. And for their business, it's probably better to stay with timber management. But I think in the long run, there's 6.3 billion people in the world today. We're headed for between 9 and 11 billion people within the next century. We are not going to have the luxury of managing areas for individual values. We need to manage large areas for multiple values, not all values all the time in the same place. We need a mosaic across the landscape, such as the triad, where you have conservation areas, old growth areas, areas where you let fires and insects and disease operate because that's natural. And at the other end, we have areas of monoculture, short rotation plantations, managed sustainably to sustain soil and water, but not maintaining all biodiversity values. So we need a diversity of approaches from variable retention harvesting, emulation of natural disturbance. All these different ideas have a place, but no one of them should become the mantra.
This morning you've been speaking to the audience at the forestry conference about modeling, and certainly modeling has become more and more a part of the way science is done. But is that enough? Are there other ways that we should be dealing with this?
I like to use the analogy of architects, builders, and brick and two-by-four makers. In science, we have to reduce the complexity of nature, of ecosystems, down to testable hypotheses. If we can't test and reject a hypothesis, we never know whether we should accept it or reject it. So science inevitably goes from experience into understanding-based science, where we break everything down into simple little bits that we can test. It's like taking the movie of life. A movie is just a series of pictures flashed in front of your eyes very quickly, and each picture has many components in it. So science takes one frame out of the movie, breaks it down into its components, and looks at each part as a testable hypothesis. And that's analogous to the bricks and 2x4s and the glass and the wiring in a building. We cannot build buildings without glass and 2x4s. So most science, most scientists, should go on being scientific brick and 2x4 makers, helping us to understand, breaking down complexity. But we tend to put that complexity into warehouses. We have warehouses full of academic bricks and 2x4s, and we call them libraries. And they don't serve society very well. They serve professors and students, and they get you promoted and tenured, but they tend not to solve society's problems because those problems are complex. Only when we have a scientific architect and a scientific builder that takes all that wonderful understanding knowledge, the bits and pieces of the frame of the movie of life, puts them back into frames and then stitches them together into a movie and runs it over time, does the full value of science to society occur. So that's my excuse for doing modeling. I think most people should be studying reality, because our knowledge is still very incomplete. However, our ability to solve the problems that face society is less to do with our incomplete knowledge, but more to do with our failure to use what we already know. If we used what we already knew, we could make huge progress today. And so we need models that deal with complexity, that take the results of the academic brick and 2x4 manufacturing, which most scientists should do, build them into large conceptual models of how ecosystems work, have clever people who make computer programs, I can't do that, programmers who can make computer programs that represent this knowledge, and then run them out into the future to say, what could happen in the future? Now, all models are wrong, only reality is correct, but we don't have reality of the future, so we're forced to do modeling. We only have reality of the past. So to get a virtual reality of the future, we take these models, understanding that they can never predict the future exactly. It's far too complex, but they can give us a really good understanding of what might happen. And on that basis, we can make more ethical choices about what we do today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Hamish Kimmins, a professor of forest ecology at the University of British Columbia. His research is supported in part by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, and he was in Edmonton recently, speaking at the International Forestry Conference, One Forest Under Two Flags. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, Ducks Unlimited Canada, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.